The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins is brought to you this week by our most comfortable sponsor, Mack Weldon. Make sure you listen in to hear just how comfortable Mack Weldon is by checking out the spot later in the program. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. Enjoy the program.
Dee Watkins here with The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today I'll be joined by my co-host, Amelia McDonald Perry. Amelia is a writer, reporter, and editor with over 15 years of experience in media. I'll also be joined by Tawana Jones, who's an advocate and warrior for fighting for accountability since the untimely death of her big brother, Tyrone West. Tawana holds West Wednesdays every week, and we'll have some information at the end of the show on how you can support her, and we'll get a chance to hear her story and give you the information you need to know about that. We also have Seth Stoughton. Seth is an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, where he's affiliated with the Rule of Law Collaborative. He teaches in the criminal law area, including criminal law, criminal procedure, and the regulation of vice. Seth served as an officer with the Tallahassee Police Department for 5 years. And we have Tierra Lanice, host and creator of Pretty Girl Radio. Tierra is an advocate, community activist, and she does entry work in community engagement with DTLR throughout the city. Thank you guys for joining. How's everyone?
Good.
Good.
I want to start with the conversation around lead. Amelia, I know you've been doing the research, and Tawanda and myself and Tierra, we're familiar, you know, with the term, you know, he has lead or she has lead. Many of us, probably some of me, I know I've had traces of lead in my blood. My brother received a check. My cousin got a really big check. We wasn't approached by the type of company, the company that ripped Freddie off. You know, we didn't have the opportunity to be ripped off like that. But, you know, I know a lot of people are. A lot of people are taken advantage of. And it's a serious issue in this city. So let's start the conversation there. I want to go to you, Amelia, first. And
yeah, so Freddie was one of many, many, many children in Baltimore who were poisoned by lead because of lead paint that was on the walls in many of the homes in Baltimore. Apparently, I had no idea, but apparently lead paint chips, they have like a sweet taste to them. And so little kids who kind of, you know, grab at the walls and peel off the paint, sticking them in their mouths, sort of ended up getting lead poisoning that way. And I had no idea the effects of lead on basically the entire body, all of the organs, the brain, all of that, how devastating it can be in terms of development. You know, it can have a lifelong impact on people and their ability to work, to go to school, to do well in school. And so a large amount of people were sort of paid off by the city of Baltimore for having experienced lead paint poisoning that wasn't, you know, rectified in their homes.
Yeah, we make light of it, but it's a serious issue.
It really is. I had no idea the sort of lasting effects that lead can have on a person's ability to sort of grow and develop their brains even. And, you know, so what's sad about it, well, so many things are sad about it, but in terms of sort of the money that was given to victims of lead paint poisoning, was supposed to be sort of like a way of appeasing, a way of being like, you know, of apologizing in a way of being like, here's some money. But that money is supposed to last a person's entire sort of life, and it's supposed to make up for the ways in which lead paint poisoning and lead poisoning can have on their ability to work and to get an education. And for many of these people in these sort of lower income communities, they were also sort of taken advantage of by these organizations that would come in and basically sort of buy their sort of payments off of them and giving them immediate money. So if you were somebody like Freddie's family, and Freddie and his siblings were all given lead paint checks, it was a way of sort of getting the money sort of immediately. So if you were dependent upon that money and you couldn't wait for the, you know, you wanted sort of more of a lump sum payout, there were these companies that came in and sort of exploited the situation. It's doubly devastating.
You know, we used to always like make jokes when we were coming up about if somebody had lead, like the first thing they would buy would be like 30 dirt bikes and like 20 Gucci belts, and then the money would be gone. But like I said, it's a serious issue, and it's something that's affected so many families. And And not only, you know, so you have these landlords that are able to, you know, be able to have some type of insurance or put forth some type of money, you know, to pay for this. But then you have these companies. What was it? Access Financial?
Yeah. Yeah.
To just come in. Access Financial to just
Access
come in.
Access Funding. Yeah.
Funding. Access Funding to come in and to rip these people off. What experiences, Tierra, have you had with Dad or Ohan about these stories just growing up in West Baltimore?
For me, not even just growing up in West Baltimore, I have a young nephew now. He's only 1 year old who's actually just got tested for lead, and they said that he has high levels. So we still have homes in Baltimore that still carry high levels of lead. Like when I listened to Emil earlier, it's like, a lot of landlords are still covering up the fact because they don't think that their tenants are going to find out. So, like I said, my nephew is one now, and he's, you know, going to get a lead check per se. And hopefully, you know, Access Funding doesn't come in.
Well, they're on an investigation.
There's probably
now.
Some other yeah. version of them, they, some other.
But I'm pretty sure that's what exactly.
Whoever the new Access exactly. Funding is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to Seth, you teach criminal law. These guys are crooks, right?
well, probably. This is the sad part of our legal system. You would think so, but unless there's a consumer protection law that prevents it, maybe not.
Yeah.
There's a pretty good likelihood that one of Maryland's consumer protection laws does protect from some of the activity, but the law pretty much allows you to make a bad deal. And that means that it also allows people to make a bad deal seem like a good deal by relying on your limited information. You know, most people are not very sophisticated consumers, particularly of financial services. I certainly am not. So when you have a company that comes in and says, look, yeah, you're going to get $150,000 over the course of your lifetime. We're going to give you $20,000 or what did Freddie got? $18,000. We're going to give you that right up front.
Yeah. And if you need the money immediately, it becomes a sort of, even if you're aware of the fact that you're being ripped off, it becomes a matter of survival where, yeah, I'm getting ripped off, but I need the money now.
Honestly, like, the lifespan of living in Baltimore doesn't guarantee that you're going to see $150,000 when they, you know, in those payments. Right. So it's like, well, I probably got 5 years to live.
Like it's like a selling point. Tawana, did you ever hear any stories like about companies like this or?
Just the kind of feedback. So when I hear y'all, even though y'all talking about lead paint and, you know, and stuff like that, and it's just to me, always say like a poor man's reality is police brutality, because I just think about the living conditions on where they have most of, like, you know, Baltimore, we know as the two cities of, you know, has two cities into one. And it's just ironically that a lot of, you know, black neighborhoods are filled with lead paint, abandoned houses and things like that. And the first thing they want to do is, like, instead of holding people really accountable, they want to come up with a paycheck. Like, and that's just disgusting to me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just kind of like listening to that just all kind of falls back on this system that basically screws black people over in all ways, you know, and always it screws us over.
I'm from the Annie Jones era, when homicides was high. Every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West I be getting money, but it's different on my side.
Folks, it's almost summertime, and for me, that means it's going to get hot. Like, really hot. And my poor husband will be braving the streets for work every morning and praying that by the time he gets to his office, he won't look like he just ran a marathon. So this summer, I'm going to surprise him with a few items from Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon will be on the front line of his battle against the swamp-like conditions in DC with their smartly designed underwear, socks, shirts, and undershirts made with premium fabrics. And when he gets home, he can slip into Mack Weldon hoodies and sweatpants and enjoy that Mack Weldon difference all day. So if you're bracing yourself for the heat or simply looking for some extra comfort in your wardrobe, check out Mack Weldon. They also offer a line of silver undergarments and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, so you can smell as fresh at 5 p.m. as you did at 9 a.m. So try out Mack Weldon today. If you find it's not your thing, you can get a refund and you can keep your first pair. So this summer, if you're working out, going out, staying in, or in motion, Mack Weldon has the right stuff for you. Undisclosed listeners, go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order using promo code UNDISCLOSED.
I'm happy that you are here today, Tawan, is just to talk about different pieces of your story. I feel like we've been talking about how incompetent a lot of police officers have been, extremely heartless at times. But I think that, you know, we get an academic side and we get like the side of us giving commentary on these issues. But your personal story and what happened to your brother and how it's transformed you and the work you've been doing has been so powerful. I think people really need to know the human side of what that type of pain is. Today, the Washington Post just put an article out naming Baltimore City as the murder capital of the country. So it's really, really tough times in the city right now. And, you know, the different things that are happening in different neighborhoods on top of all of these other systemic things that allow these things to happen on top of the police officers who present a greater evil and are never held accountable. But just talk about your own experience and what you do with West Wednesdays and how it came about.
Basically, just to jump right into what happened to my brother. He basically was brutally murdered almost 4 years ago, July 18th, 2013. That was like the worst day of my life. My brother was executed. We had no transparency. We wasn't even good enough to get a phone call that nobody family dreads to get. Basically, had it not been for the grace of God, I was able to feel my brother's pain at approximately the time frame in which he was getting the life pepper spray, beat, tased, and everything out of him. I was feeling that pain after he had just left me within a half an hour. He's brutally executed, beat to death in front of numerous witnesses. Witnesses camped out there with their cell phones. Witnesses tried to stop these killer maniac cops, and to no avail, they were able to brutally murder my brother. But what was really horrifying about the whole ordeal to learn that the first two killer cops, Nicholas Davis Chapman and Officer Ruiz, the first ones who pulled my Mercedes-Benz over at the time that my brother was borrowing to go and pick up a female who was stranded. So he lost his life in term trying to do somebody a favor. You know, he's no longer here all because he said, sis, may I borrow your ride? This young lady is stranded and I just want to help her out. And I'm like, go ahead, you know. But nevertheless, to talk about the two killer cops, the first two at the scene who basically were in plain clothes or whatever. And my brother didn't even know he was being pulled over. They claimed that he was driving too slow. We heard two tales. And it's sad because whenever you lie, the lie keeps changing, but the truth never changed. So far as the traffic stop, we heard that he was driving too slow towards the stop sign. Then we heard another tale that, oh, he was dipping down and he went to go back up or some foolishness that does not warrant a death sentence at all. And long story short, my brother was executed by Nicholas Davis Chapman and Ruiz. But the horrifying part that I was saying, these are repeat violent offenders. They almost killed Abdul Salam on July the 1st, and nobody was held accountable. Abdul did everything. And so immediately, once my brother was executed in such a horrible fashion, my family knew that something wasn't right, because we're tracking down people that should have, in fact, indeed been tracking us down. But with the lack of, you know, just talking to my family as we were human beings concerned about our loved ones, they avoided us. And we went to them finally, like I said, after me feeling horrible, and then everything that my worst nightmare was confirmed on the news. Late breaking news at 10 o'clock, we saw that. And then we went back down yet again to homicide. They brushed my family off, told us they were going to come, you know, and leave an address. We'll come to you guys tomorrow. That they were dealing with a homicide in the city, things of that nature. And it was horrible because at the time, a young girl had got her throat slashed or whatever. And it was just horrible. So I kind of turned my pain off to respect Diamond's family. And the saddest part, I never knew that I would wind up in counseling with Diamond's grandmother, Nanny. I went there to Roberta's house to seek counseling to try to learn how to deal with that kind of pain that's so real that could actually, my life, my normal life ended, like literally, to be honest. So immediately we were out in the streets going, asking people. We started something called West Wednesday that following week, even though we were out there the very next day, because the officers walked in our house basically telling my family, my brother's body didn't even have the autopsy done on it yet, but yet they're walking in my family's house 11 o'clock in the morning telling us what the autopsy report was going to later say 5 months later. So I hope y'all didn't miss that point. 5 months later, they gave us some foolishness, bull crap, 5 months later, saying them out. Because when they walked in, they were like, we just want to be transparent with your family. We want to make sure Mr. West didn't have any heart issues. And I'm like, no, he didn't have any heart issues. He just got a healthy physical 2 weeks ago. You want to see it? I got the proof. No, Ms. Jones, if we need it, we'll get in contact with you later. And also, we want to make sure that the heat and hot weather didn't exacerbate Mr. West's death and things of that nature. And I'm like, well, if anybody should have been passing out there, these cops were fully dressed in gear. They should have been the first ones to hit the ground. My brother had on a tank top and shorts. Like, what are you talking about? So long story short, all of the lies. It took them 5 months to give my family a partial autopsy. But before, with the interesting part, before they gave us this autopsy report, we got a leak from a reporter that worked at Morgan, a student reporter that worked for Morgan. And mind you, one of the officers, one of the 15 officers named David Lewis that arrived at the scene, he literally sat on my brother's dying back. He had his foot in his neck and his back. I mean, he had his foot and his knee in my brother's back and his foot on my brother's neck, and my brother was in a prone position, face down, handcuffed into a hog tie position. And that's, if anybody don't know, that's when the your hands are meeting in the center of your back along with your legs. So he was shackled, chained, and it was horrible. And then you let a 315-pound man, after he'd been pepper sprayed, beat, tased, kick stomped, hit with the batons and all that for over 25 minutes. You let a 315-pound man set him. So I had got a leak from her stating that, oh, you know, that the medical examiner's office is going to come out with their report tomorrow. And this is 5 months later, mind you. She said, you know, your brother was killed from positional asphyxiation. I'm like, oh my God, this is horrible. I'm crying. But then it was ironically that the next day when the medical examiner's office come on, Bruce Goldfarb come on with his foolishness talking about, so my brother basically died from a heart attack due to dehydration, the same foolishness that they came been telling us before they even did the autopsy. They told me the autopsy wasn't going to be done until 2:30 that evening, but yet 11:30, you're walking in my family's house telling us what the autopsy was going to say. And it's ridiculous. So then last year, we got our professional expert through my attorneys, because we're in the civil trial and whatnot, because the first one we seek attorneys, the reason why we seek them, we wanted criminal charges off the top. And to this day, I'm still working for criminal charges, because to me, that's real accountability. But nevertheless,
you did all of this work and you active every week, and you know, everybody knows you, and we've been hearing the story. But what about some of the stories that we don't know? Like, how often do you think this happens?
So now what I'm learning, this is a pattern and it's practice and it's happening all over, but you just don't hear that report. So when I've been connected with West Winds, he's going to different events all over the world, meeting different horrified parents that are suffering the same tragic loss. What I'm noticing that's ironic and interesting is that the one family members, like my sister Ishtime, her daughter was killed in Texas in a prison in Texas, beat to death like an hour after she was placed into the, you know, into the care. She died. But long story short, she never received the proper autopsy report. And I'm no pictures and things like that. I'm like, hold up. I never received any pictures. What is there, something going on? Then I have another sister who's in D.C. Her son, Lonzo, was beat to death. He was a teacher. He was beat to death by special police officers in the same way that, and when she described the officer having his foot in her son's neck until he wasn't no longer breathing, I'm like, wait a minute, you got to be kidding me. Is this the way they train them to kill all black men? Because when I'm hearing her say what happened to my brother, it's like, I'm listening. I testify about what happened to my brother. And when I asked her, I said, well, excuse me, well, did you ever get a full autopsy report? She said, no, I haven't, never got no pictures. So I'm thinking, like, this is something that they do. So it's like so many stories, and even the stories that, like you said, unknown, and even the ones you heard, like I remember it was another big case, I forgot, but somebody was on TV and it was on CNN, and the mom was up there saying how her child was beat to death, and she was like, where are the autopsy pictures? And I'm like, well, this is a conscious conspiracy to obstruct justice. This is exactly what it is.
I think that there's something that's interesting about Tawanda's story about her brother, about Tyrone West, is that, well, you know, Tyrone's death did not get nearly the media attention that Freddie Gray's did. And what's interesting when you look at both cases, and, you know, we've been looking very deeply into whether or not there was this cover up and to cover up the death of Freddie Gray. And when you look at what happened to Tyrone West, you see a much, much, much sloppier cover up. Like, and that's what, and what it makes you sort of realize is that when there isn't the media attention on there, what's really sort of going on behind the scenes in these sort of cases. And what's interesting is it sort of really makes what happened in the Freddie case, and I would go as far as to say that there was definitely a concerted, you know, cover up as far as that's concerned, but it looks so much more polished and well done compared to, I mean, it's galling once you do some research into, you know, what happened to Tyrone West. And that's, I'm hoping to do, I've interviewed already Tawanda and I'm hoping to do something with that. But when you really look at that case, what happened to him, they didn't even really try to cover it up. And the fact that nothing has been done is what's utterly shocking. And on top of that, I also think what's something that's interesting is that that case really sort of illuminates the fact that autopsy reports conducted by medical examiners are not always the rock solid, irrefutable evidence that you would, or that we, I think, people as a whole sort of expect them to be.
Are they like stats? You can just make it say what you need to say?
I don't want to generalize and say this is across the board always the case. I mean, keep in mind that, you know, I think it really depends on what the overall investigation is about, who the victim is, who is potentially the sort of perpetrator. But in a case like this, where the police are being investigated, you know, I think you have to look pretty hard at how those autopsies are being conducted and what information is being given to the medical examiner. You know, the medical examiner is not out there investigating it on their own. They are largely, you know, they look at the medical records. They obviously do the autopsy itself, the physical autopsy, both internal and external. But then there's also the context in which that person died that is very, very important to determining a cause of death or a manner of death. Like, you know, just looking at a body is not going to tell you the full story. It maybe tell you, you know, if somebody's been shot to death, that will be obvious. But the circumstances in which a death occurs are informed by the information that's provided to the medical examiner. And very often, well, in 99% of the time, that information is provided to them by the police. And so when you have a death in custody or a death at the hands of police, and police are providing the information that informs the circumstances in which that death occurred, things get problematic, let's just say. And it's not to say that the medical examiner is making a call based on the information they're given. I think that there are certainly times where there are reasons to really sort of question the medical examiner's conclusions. I think that's certainly the case in the case of Tyrone West. I think in Freddie's case, the medical examiner was given very limited information on which to base her opinion. So it's not that her opinion is wrong necessarily. I think in many ways it's correct, her assessment of his injury. But the circumstances in which he sustained that injury to his neck, Freddie's neck, were so limited in what she was sort of told. And so that completely sort of changes the outcome in which when she was trying to sort of determine when his neck was broken and what the immediate effects were, because it was all entirely based on the accounts of the police officers who were involved in detaining and arresting and transporting him. So that's where you really sort of look at, you know, when you look closely at an autopsy, you have to wonder, has this conclusion been influenced by a narrative that has a particular goal in mind? And that's where, you know, it's incredibly important in any case where a person dies in police custody or at the hands of police that there be an external investigation, a completely independent investigation, where people who are not tied very closely to the agencies that are sort of being investigated are not tasked with then sort of making those kind of calls. If that makes sense.
So Seth, you worked as a cop for a few years and you taught other police officers how to write reports. Was it just like a position that was given to you, or did you recognize like a big problem and try to do something about it?
Probably a combination of the two with regard to the instruction that I provided in report writing. many officers are not good writers. They might be very good at interacting with people. They might be good in a number of other ways, but they're not always good at recording information in a way that is going to make sense to an audience, a reader, later. So it wasn't the agency that I worked for, Tallahassee Police Department, had just switched to a computerized reporting system. So instead of writing reports on paper, we were now typing them up on computers. And they took that change as an opportunity to also do report writing training. So at the same time that officers learned how to use the software, they were also getting some training on how to go about writing reports. I didn't see many attempts to intentionally skew the facts in some way or another. But I certainly saw and continue to see officers present facts in a way that seems totally right and natural to them at the time, but still maybe somewhat one-sided. We all have our own biases that affect the way that we interpret the world around them. And one of the things that officers need to be exposed to and need to be trained in is how to try to present their findings and conclusions in as objective a manner as possible, recognizing that some of those observations and conclusions are going to be affected by their own personal and professional biases.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, and you can speak to this, and anyone else, feel free to jump in whenever you want to. But it seems like, how do we even, you know, it's understanding the technology and understanding the proper way to write reports is something that's definitely important. But it's like from the community side, the distrust is just, it's so present that we can't even see even trusting some of the things that are going on within the department in general. Like, it's kind of hard for us to even get to that point, because we feel like even looking at what happened with Freddie, we're looking at what happened with Tyrone. We can't even get to the part of if the reports are accurate or not.
Right. And I believe that with that, it's like they played the guys that was in the van with Freddie. Like, they played them to, you know, hey, if you say this is what happened, then you'll get less time. You'll be released in this time. Like, just to even do that is too much for me to just sit back and be like, oh yeah, I'm sure that he was strapped in and I'm sure he was sitting on the floor. For me, I've been inside of the van before and I was never strapped in.
Right. I've yet to meet a single person you know, who said that they were seatbelted inside of a transport van.
Right. So even in the car, as I drive, my daughter says, whoa, ma. So if my daughter's saying, whoa, when I'm making a right turn and she's sliding halfway over into my seat and she can actually put her hand out to protect herself from falling, like, it's just like the evidence is kind of there and they still kind of, you know, trying to massage it and say, oh, well, he was banging his head up against the wall. It's like, yeah, if you fly across from one bench to the other one, I'm pretty sure. But on purpose? No, not at all.
There are two essential components for really any form of police investigation, but particularly a use of force investigation or a police homicide investigation when the police kill someone. The investigation and the ultimate conclusion has to be accurate. It has to be done the right way. It has to have reliable information and methodology. So, for example, witnesses shouldn't be interviewed together. They should be interviewed separately, right? Discrepancies should be followed up upon. But in addition to accuracy, it also has to be legitimate. The best report, the best investigation in the world is not going to help anyone if the community does not trust it. Mm-hmm. And that's where independent investigations become so important. Once trust has broken down, or maybe never even existed, between a police agency and community members, there's very little reason for community members to trust the results of any form of internal investigation. So in order, even if it's an accurate investigation, it's not going to be judged as accurate because it's not trusted. So to get that legitimacy, to get the trust of it, that's where independent investigations, outside investigations, some form of other entity coming in to do the investigation is critically important.
So not to shoot down what the gentleman was saying, but I just feel like, to me, whenever they investigate into killing a citizen, that's when it becomes biased at that moment. it's like, I don't feel like they need to be trained on how to write the report, because when it's something else, they get real accurate with it. But when they kill us and they do something wrong, they're not going to admit they're wrong. They're not going to admit, oh, I pulled him out by his dreadlocks and I began pepper spraying. They're not going to write that down in the report. What they do, what I'm seeing in Baltimore City and basically all around the world, all they do is make things fit into that narrative that they're trying to create. And so when you talked about this corrupt system, or when I talk about this corrupt system, because there's layers of it. So what you do is you start off by the media. The media works close hand with the police officers. Let's be clear. They always go get their side and whatever they say. So if they, like the guy that got shot on, I believe it was Black Friday, right on Greenmount Avenue, and broad daylight, officers could have shot a child. Anybody, he got gunned down right there on Greenmount Avenue, and the narrative was, oh, a knife welding man. We don't know the name of this man yet to this day. We didn't hear any more about it. But what I'm saying, I say all I like to say, and even with my brother's case, oh, there was a struggle with police officers. There wasn't no damn struggle. Let's be real clear. The only thing my brother was struggling for was to survive, to breathe air, to scream for help. So there was no struggle. But what I say all this to say with these narratives, so when they start writing these fake reports, then you got the media backing them. So whatever, they go to the killer cops first and they get their narrative. Oh, it was a struggle. Bam. So now no matter what type of truth comes out, they're going to always stick with that first scenario, even through me fighting tirelessly and endlessly, showing where these animals did something savage, horrific, and everything. They keep with this narrative. Mr. West died in a struggle. That was a struggle means that as soon as you came to me, I started resisting. Nobody never said my brother was resisting. The only ones that ever had that nerve was, I mean, that narrative was the killer cops. Nobody else. He didn't even know why he was being, A, pulled out by his dreadlocks, beat to death. He didn't know that. And once he realized, he's like, what are you doing? And he's screaming to no avail. Then, of course, it's fight or flight. I'm not going to stand there and let you keep kicking me and stomp me in my head. I'm going to be running. But at the same time he was running, he was screaming, help. So if he was trying to avoid or struggle with anybody, he would have got out swinging. So let's be clear. So the reason why, so back to my whole point, I just, like I said, don't believe nothing that they write down on that piece of paper. They think that they can write, and they can. They can write down anything. And the saddest part, I have never seen any transparent thing, even with Anthony Anderson's death, was ruled a homicide. But after all the little so-called investigative reports, it came back, oh, well, the officers act within reason. What kind of reasonable force to kill one unarmed person? Like, how many kicks, stomps, tased, pepper sprays tossed on their neck? It's a bunch of foolishness, and I'm sick of it. And it's like, so when you talk about the crooked medical examiner's office, you got to talk about the crooked doctors, you got to talk about the crooked lawyers, the judges that allow this foolishness. It is a real messed up, corrupt system.
And the media, you got to throw the media in there too.
That's why I said the media has the strongest power. They got somebody's life in there, and they can make innocent people look guilty and guilty people look innocent. Shame on them. So I said, you got to talk about all this corruption. So it don't just like stop and just kill a cop. You got to talk about the media. You got to talk about everybody involved in that sick circle that keeps going on and allowing these type of injustices, regardless if you got credible eyewitnesses that did not know my brother from a can of paint, that came out there and said what they saw, that had video footage that the police officers, along with, at the time, Commissioner Betts, went and took everybody's cell phone video footage. Even in a motion phase, we're unable to get these video footage, which we know that that plays a crucial part. Look at Freddie Gray. If they wouldn't have saw him screaming in agonizing pain before he got in the van, you wouldn't even have knew about Freddie Gray. You wouldn't even be able to just brush that under the rug. So let's be clear, it's a bunch of foolishness to me, and they know exactly what they're doing. It's not like, oh, a mistake is when I didn't mean to, and it's something that happened maybe now. This is happening over and over, all over and over again, repeatedly, and it's happening for a reason, because they know that they can get away with it, because nobody's being held accountable, nobody's challenging nothing, doing what they do. They're quick to write a family off some hush money and send them over there, because once we write you off this check, now you can't talk about your loved one. You can't even tell the killer cops that was involved in your loved one. So when Killer Ruiz and Chapman come and kill again, the families won't know, because we gave you this big fat check to shut up. No, keep your money, put it up your butt. I'm going to talk about my brother. I'm going to talk about everybody. I'm going to talk about all the victims of police brutality. And I feel like that's what everybody needs to be like that. And until we get a bunch of everybody being like that, we're going to keep on having these big injustices. And the only people that we really can blame at the end of the day is ourselves, because we keep on allowing them to do this to us. And I look at, like, even with the uprise, and that was the day when all the gang members and everybody came together, Christians, Muslims, everybody came together, and that was so powerful. And what happened immediately after that? Look at how the spike of crime shot up in the city. Like, come on. Well, no, they, and there's always an unknown shooting. I know, I'm sick of that. Like, they know exactly what they're doing. This is purposely happening. It's the Wild Wild West. This is Harm City. It ain't Charm City. Welcome to Harm City.
Well, I think a lot of police departments, and I think that there's corruption everywhere. Baltimore has really excelled at having a very long history of corruption that has, it leaks into both, not just the police department, but all sorts of agencies. And getting rid of that and purifying that and making it good again is a very difficult process that I don't even know how you would begin.
Well, the cops here have a great talent, Amelia. They're really good at lying and then believing their own lies. Once you get, once you deal with a system full of people that can lie, they can really say, hey, look me in the face and say, you know what? You are a 34-year-old white man. And I can say, no, I'm not. No, no, you are.
And I'll tell you why.
And I'll tell you. And if not, I'm going to blow your fucking head off.
Right. Because so, I can. Because and I'll nobody, get away with it.
So I'm going to throw this out here to the whole panel. I think that the Baltimore City Police Department should just be gutted. Like, I just think they should be gutted. Like, I think I see them as being worthless. That's my opinion. It's how I feel. I've said this on other episodes. I'll say it again. It's my first time getting to meet Seth. But flat out, I feel like the only time I ever would call a cop is if I needed an insurance report for something that was stolen out of my car or out of my crib. Other than that, I would, and I don't even want to call them for that, because that's even like a hassle. So people say, well, D, we can't live in a society without laws and people to enforce. And I'm saying I already do, because if you rob me, I'm not going to call a cop.
I'm not.
The point? Hello? 911? Yeah, man. Well, you know, these guys just robbed me and, you know, they stole my stuff. Okay, well, get a report and have a good day.
Yeah. Honestly, even I got in a car accident a couple months ago and I was like reluctant to actually call the police. Like, I'm like, can we not exchange information and trust that we could? And she called, and that's fine with me. I don't. And then when he came, did you guys talk about it? And it's like, yeah, she hit me. That. Okay, cool. Here's the report. And that was it. It wasn't like
I think they need to be gutted. I think we need to just start fresh. I think we need to just get rid of the whole police department. And I'll throw it out
nowhere.
To the panel. It out to the panel.
We got nowhere. Put it that way.
You can't clean a dirty house with a filthy mop. Let's be real clear on that.
I like the way
that's a great way of putting it. Yes.
That's great. You know what's funny about that, Tawana? I just told my students the other day, because we were talking about, like, I was talking about how, like, all the stuff I've been through in the streets and, you know, how I try to do all this community work and work with kids and books and all that. And I told them dirty water can put out a fire. Mm-hmm. But you're right. This house is dirty. And we have a dirty mop and a broken Febreze container. Yes. And just,
honestly.
And just, you know.
Right. It's like, if we say it needs to be gutted, how do we start gutting? Like,
if all you guys can respond to that, I think that the police department in Baltimore City should just be gutted from the, you know, dig out the roots, dig the roots out, throw all of them away, throw them in the inner harbor somewhere. And
I mean, but that'll be your judicial system as well, because they're friends.
Bye.
And then your lawyers, because they're friends, you know, and like,
bye, see y'all.
Right. And, you know, and then, yeah, I had to say that because I see people, you know, have these relationships. Yeah. Go Seth.
Two thoughts, right? One, that has happened and has worked at least decently well in other cities. Newark, New Jersey is an example of that. They had so many problems with their police department that they disbanded it, and then it reformed about 9 months later. And it's not perfect. It has issues, as every community and police agency does. But by any measure, it is significantly better than the police department that it replaced. The other part, you're absolutely right. Just replacing the police agency doesn't get at the whole root of what allowed the police agency to exist the way that it does.
Right.
So, for example, Maryland, particularly, Maryland has very, very powerful police unions and very restrictive laws, including what are called police officer Bill of Rights,
right.
mm-hmm. that limit the ability of a police agency to investigate and discipline an officer, even when everyone in the police agency wants to.
Right.
So correcting or replacing a police agency, it'll get you down the road a little bit. But there are a lot of other components that went into building that road that led to what you currently have in the Baltimore Police Department.
Right. And you're somebody who, you know, one of the things that we used your interview for in the episode, in this most recent episode, is in terms of just like police training, in terms of how they physically handle suspects when they detain them, when they're arresting them. You know, one of the things I think is interesting in the Freddie cases, even at the first stop, you know, they were holding him down in a leg lace position for a really long time. And one of the things you told us is that that's a position that should be only used for a very brief period of time, just as long as it takes to put somebody in handcuffs. And because laying on your stomach, being forced down on your stomach, especially with weight on top of you, can lead to positional asphyxia. It didn't in this case, but it has happened. And because it restricts your breathing. And there were so many ways when we look at the, you know, what happened to Freddie Gray, in which his body was treated, his personhood was treated as there was just no regard for it, whether it was repeatedly putting a knee into his neck, which is not the proper way of, like, you talk about using the knee on somebody's back can be a way of sort of keeping them down while you handcuff them if they're sort of fighting back against you. But to keep them, to put it in their neck isn't going to work. And to continually do that can only really kind of cause pain and not actually accomplish what the sort of restraining goal should be.
But then you still have people that are like back. You have people that back that up, that say, well, you know, they had to do what they had to do. Or you have people out there who defend these officers. And I'm just wondering, like, are people that evil? Am I missing something?
They are that evil, especially when you talk about the FOP who have the same exact lawyers fighting for the same killer, different killer cops, but the same ones coming in the court with their suits on, marching around killers, and they know they killers, and they don't care, and they can go back and sit and have coffee with these animals and everything and laugh at the families. They don't care. They don't even look at us like humans. And half the time, they send somebody cooning. And when I say brother, and you see at every courthouse, and you're like, wait a minute, that's the ones that was representing them killer cops that murdered my brother. Wait a minute, that's the women. He's still representing them that murdered, you know, to try to kill Anthony Annis. They don't care. They don't care. They don't care. That's just flat out. They don't care.
I don't think it's a matter of evil. I think evil's in the eye of the beholder there. But I think it is a matter of how officers and others in the system look at the police role. What role are officers supposed to be playing in the community? And that sets the tone for the relationship between officers. When an agency or an officer or a lawyer or anyone else views officers as part of that that thin blue line that is all that separates society from criminal anarchy and chaos, it's very easy to dismiss collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
When you take the view that I have of police, the primary role of police should be to protect civilians from unnecessary indignity and harm, I think it changes your view of the proper way for police to interact with people and the proper techniques for them to do. Police will need to commit indignities on people, right? Putting someone in handcuffs and taking them to the jail is an indignity. Sometimes it is a necessary indignity. Using force causes harm. Sometimes it is a necessary harm. But when officers are not protecting individuals from unnecessary indignity and harm, including unnecessary indignity and harm that may be committed incidentally or intentionally by officers themselves, then I think they have fundamentally failed the police role.
So I think what I struggle with it is that, you know, if you look at some of the things that came out in the Ferguson report, racial slurs, how they were told to police those black communities, frequent use of the N-word. And I look at what happened with guys like Tyrone West or like Freddie Gray. And we have all of this evidence. We know that some of the cops knew that their partners and their coworkers and the people who are supposed to be protecting with them didn't do their jobs in the way in which they supposed to do their jobs. And then they didn't do anything and they don't say anything. And they know that this is a murder. And they know that if their brother was murdered, they would feel horrible. But yet they still don't have the heart or the nuts or the moral code to say anything. I struggle calling it anything but evil.
Right. Sometimes they're not perceiving it. Sometimes they don't perceive it as wrongdoing. And sometimes they do perceive it as wrongdoing. But the weight of the culture that they're in is so heavily on them that they don't feel like they can do anything about it.
It's sort of like what happened to Joe Crystal. You know, that's one of the things I know that you guys talked about on the addendum last week is the fact that, you know, there are examples of police officers who have stood up and reported brutality on, you know, the part of their colleagues. And, you know, in Baltimore, you have a guy like Joe Crystal who was like immediately ran out of town, which certainly if there are those other officers in the department who saw that, that doesn't give them a lot of incentive to sort of speak up. I think what you actually see is I sort of have been fascinated by the officers who were sort of tangentially related to what happened to Freddie, like who were at some of the stops but weren't charged. You know, three of them, almost pretty soon after everything happened, left Baltimore police. They went to go work at other police departments. And, you know, I haven't been able to get them to talk to me, but I'm hoping that maybe they'll change their mind at some point. But I wonder if that was their way of being like, I can't stand to stay here and be part of this. But I also know that if I speak up, it's not going to help anything.
So the culture that comes on my 9-to-5 should allow me to sit around and watch people be murdered, and that's okay?
No, God, no, of course not. I mean, I think personally,
there's problems.
Yeah.
But it's a real problem. I mean, it exists. It's not to excuse the individual actions, but it is to explain it. And once we have the explanation, then we can start working on it. So I think it's problematic when we individualize, when we say that a problem is just the result of an individual's choices or actions without looking at the bigger system, the systemic problems, whether that's racism or poverty or the connection between the two. And when we say individual officers should be speaking up more, you're right. But we have to explain why are they not? And one of the reasons that they're not is because of cultural pressures that make it very, very difficult to do. So then the question is, how do we fix those cultural pressures? How do we make it easy for officers to step up and say, look, this was wrong? And I can give you an example from my local sheriff's department in Richland County, South Carolina, where one of the proudest moments the sheriff had when we were talking, I had him come in to speak to my class, and he was talking about an incident where one officer overheard another officer use a racial slur. And the officer who overheard it was very comfortable going to a supervisor. And within 24 hours, the officer, the deputy who had used the racial slur, was fired. Because that's the type of culture that he spent 20 years building, where officers can correct each other and go to supervisors and say, what I saw was not right. But that has to be built. That doesn't just happen. That has to be created from the ground up and from the top down.
So why is this not happening, though? Because this is 2017. And if I feel like obviously it's not there now, what do we have to wait until 2050 before officers begin to hold each other accountable? Is it ever going to happen?
I mean, you got to wonder how you even handle this in a place like Baltimore, where it's almost the exact opposite situation, where from the bottom up and the top down, it has been the opposite, like that has become, it's become so ingrained in how they police that it's acceptable. It's like they're working from a deficit, you know, and that's where it comes down to, like, yeah, do you gut the police department? But who makes that kind of call even? Who decides, like, let's disband the police department and rebuild it? I mean, and can you even, like, I don't even know who would make that call. Who makes that decision?
We're making it right now.
But it seems like common sense, though.
Like, yeah. My question is for Seth, like you said, the pressures of, I guess, the overhead come down on you when you speak up. But at what point will one ever speak up if it's, I don't know, like I'm trying to think, because like as a mother, put it this way, if I'm telling my daughter to do something and she don't want to do it, she's eventually going to say, I don't want to do that. Even if the pressure comes down that your mom's going to look at you crazy. Like at some point they have to start standing up and saying, but if I, and then I've heard, you know, I forgot the Muslim officer who had spoke up on a panel, a lot of officers in New York, and they were saying like, if they was to stand up and say something, then they would get called a rat. And my thing is like, why is that when the practice in which to protect and serve isn't being what it is? Like, why should there be a pressure?
Well, there shouldn't. It's, I think, a complicated set of answers. One reason is because of the history, the cultural history of police. And since before the civil rights era, but really starting in the civil rights era and a little before the civil rights era, in the police professionalism movement, police became the specialists in policing. That's the self-image. That's the way that agencies and officers viewed themselves and continue to view themselves. So that makes it very difficult for an officer to say, well, I as an individual know better than my profession. Officers are influenced by their peer expectations. And one of those expectations that someone, I think Tawanda was talking about earlier, when police don't view community members as people, when they view them as something less than people, when they're all thugs, when they're all suspects, it makes it very easy to dismiss the civilian, dismiss the community member, and always just side with the officer. That's a second reason. Another reason is actually safety. There have been officers at different agencies who have said that after they have claimed about problematic practices by other officers have stopped backing them up, have stopped showing up on scenes to help out, or have showed up on scene and then left before it was resolved. So some of it's fear, fear of retaliation. None of it should be happening, but right. It does. Not at every agency and not to every extent, but it does.
And I think it creates a vicious cycle, too, because then you have these departments that are, I think, attracting recruits who are sort of almost drawn to that culture, who want to get into policing sort of for the wrong reasons, or who are, I think, more susceptible to kind of embracing certain types of policing. Whereas, and then the quote unquote good officers end up leaving and going places where their morals are not challenged in the same way. And so, you know, then you're left with a place like Baltimore, which has a lot of cops who are either, you know, abusive in some sort of way or are happy to sort of turn a blind eye to it. And, you know, so-called good officers are going to other places where they don't have to sort of be up against that, where there is nothing for them to report necessarily.
The idea of a good officer is like so crazy. Like, I don't even know, like, maybe Tawanda can speak to this. I don't even know how to even start to even have the conversation about what a good officer is. And I'm not even talking about, like, of course, you got officers that are corrupt. Like, we know them. And then we also know about the ones that make the papers and things like that. But, like, even, like, if I can't get with the idea of a good officer, if every police officer I ever met in my life is the ultimate justifiers for any and everything police officers do. Because when I do something wrong, or when somebody in my business does something wrong, I pull a card. I talk to them about it. I don't just sweep it under the rug or say, oh, well, you know, we was just out here. This is the culture. Like, I say, yo, that wasn't right. We got to fix this. And that's in every industry I ever worked in.
Facts. Same here.
Yeah, I would say the same, too. I wonder if it's like, because I would have a hard time. I just wouldn't be able to do it personally, like myself. Like, I'm not saying if I were a cop, because I can't imagine myself being a cop. But in any industry, if I were working in an environment where I saw around me people doing things that were harmful to other people, I, regardless of the reasons I may have to not speak up, because I want to keep my job, because I have bills to pay, etc., because I know nothing will be done about it, I'll just end up getting in trouble myself. You know, I wonder where I would still say something, because it's core to, you know, who I am, standing up against things like that.
We're having like a different conversation, too, I feel like.
Yeah.
I'm saying that because like Baltimore is like a 67% black city, right? And our experience in dealing with police officers is all basically based around the black experience. It's just how it is. Thanks. How it, like, this isn't like, and I'm talking as a person who, you know, I've been all over the country and many parts of the world, and I've had all types of interactions with different types of people. And when I talk to black people that live in populations that mirror Baltimore, it's always the same thing. It's always like, it's like a war on us. So, like, I've recently met Tawanda maybe like last year, year before last. I didn't know Tawanda my whole life. Like, I met Tawanda, what side of town are you from?
Northeast.
No, Tawanda from Northeast Baltimore. I'm from East Baltimore. Close, but, you know, two whole different type of experiences. But if I ask you about your relationship with police, and Tiara's from a whole way, never
it's not
part of town called West Baltimore. And if I ask both of them, and, you know, I would like for Amelia and Seth to respond to this. But if I ask Tawanda and I ask Tiara, you know, give me your whole rundown of your history with police officers as a child. What do you say?
Elementary school, they was officer friendly, and everything after that was not so friendly. Honestly, like, it's not even an experience that you're waiting to have. Like, soon as you see lights, whether it's their, you know, back lights in front of you or whatever, you just immediately like cringe, and it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that way. They weren't set there for that. Or unless they were, Seth, Tawanda.
And so with me, I would say even like being brought up, looking at like all the movies, every encounter of any movie I've seen, whether it's Boys in the Hood, Tales of the Crips, whatever, is always the police and that negative light, always, always. Like even with songs, even when you hear a song, when I was coming up, you hear Slick the Ruler, the children's story, that was about a bad cop. When the little boy dropped his gun, so went the story, he got killed. You know what I mean? So like, I always heard the negative side of police officers. And then seeing them in my neighborhood, like even now, even though I said Northeast, but now I'm in the county, but I see how it is, like living in Northeast Baltimore mostly all my life, and seeing how the guys around my way get harassed and ran off the block. It's horrible. I always think them in a negative light. And then when you go in the county, and I work in the county, when you go in the county, you see officer friendly walking the kids around. You see them being friendly in the new neighborhood that I live in. But you don't see that. That's not our norm. Like, it's ridiculous. It's the two cities of two cities.
Yeah, some of that at least is historical. Police in the U.S. particularly, they came from a whole bunch of different institutions, but policing in the U.S., and elsewhere in the world is in part about social control, keeping power with a particular segment of the population and making sure that society stays stable, which means keeping that group in power in some way. So in the South, one of the precursors to modern policing were city militias and slave patrols, both of which did a lot of oppression. Scaring slaves and freed blacks, intimidating slaves and freed blacks for the express purpose to prevent rebellion. That's the history that we're built on. And I'm not saying that officers today go into the profession, go into the industry with that in mind. Pattern that we're seeing play out now with changes and some pretty significant changes. But it would be a mistake to just view policing as, you know, this new shiny service-driven profession, which is what I think the self-image of policing actually is, without looking at the history from slavery to the civil rights era to modern times. It's about power and control.
Like, how do we change that? Because, like, you know, as moved as I am by Tawanda's story and all of these different stories, I know there's going to be another one. We just had one with the young man in, was it Texas last week?
Yes.
We just had one. Like, at what point do we do something?
I think when enough people get enough upset and start putting their social and political capital, their social and political forces into play, and not until then. And that's one of the reasons why I am cautious, but I am optimistic today in the era of video cameras and cell phone cameras everywhere. The more information people have about what's happening, the better insight they have as to what the problems are. Until you get that public interest, that public buy-in, I do not think we're going to see much in the way of significant change nationally. We may see individual police agencies get much better because of a particularly reform-minded progressive police chief or sheriff. But we're not going to see a wave of reform until the public demands it.
I was having this conversation with my mom actually last night a little bit about what would get, frankly, white people as kind of a larger group to really start to sort of speak out against police brutality. And unfortunately, I think it will come down to, in a large part, to it affecting white communities and white individuals. I hate to say that because I don't feel that way personally. But that is ultimately, though, I think going to be the trickle down effect of a ever growing police state. And I do think we're sort of on the precipice of that with the new administration, with Trump and with Jeff Sessions, and sort of the there's going to be this sort of return to not return, but a further developing of largely racist, but controlling an outlook on policing that is about social control almost exclusively. And I think once that starts to affect people and who they know, then maybe we'll start to see a sort of people sort of like as the mass is really sort of rising up against it. But right now, it seems like, you know, largely the communities that are affected are having to sort of defend themselves. And what needs to happen is that people who actually have more power need to be loud and aggressive about pursuing, you know, pursuing reform and really just sort of changing our outlook on what we need police for. I think we've become completely indoctrinated into believing that the way policing happens now is actually what's necessary. And it's not. It's really not. I don't know how you start to get people to really sort of change their mindset on that until they start to see it affect somebody they know, having, you know, somebody they know their rights being violated, somebody they know being killed. I think then that makes people start to look at it.
It's like the difference between the opioid epidemic now and the crack epidemic in the 80s and early 90s.
Right.
The crack epidemic was treated primarily, almost exclusively, as a criminal issue, a criminal justice problem. And today there is significantly more support for treating the opioid epidemic as a public health issue, a medical problem. And largely that is because white kids are addicted to opium and have dying of overdoses, and folks don't want to see them arrested.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it all seems to me that, all of this comes back to white supremacy and, you know, I don't even know what to do about that. I feel, I don't know. I mean, as a person who cares about this stuff, I try and be as loud about it as I possibly can. I mean, obviously, that's something that I personally really care about. I talk to white people I know about it incessantly. But I think that there's this inability to sort of feel as deeply about things that don't affect ourselves or the people we know. And so it's very easy, I think, for people to sort of turn a blind eye or to not bother themselves with worrying about things that they think don't affect them. But eventually, this kind of growing police state will affect all of us. So we all have to,
we gotta get ready for it. So I want to go to Tierra, but after that, I want to give Tawana an opportunity to tell people where they can support, how they can support West Wednesdays and follow everything that that she's doing. She's truly an amazing person, and she's doing amazing work. And we still all hope and pray that the whole city gets justice for her brother. But go ahead, Tierra.
No, I was just gonna kind of piggyback off of what Emil was saying, because if it's an issue that you don't have to face daily, you kind of do, like, you recognize it, and then you like, oh, okay, well, they were outside. Well, they were in the neighborhood at this time and that time. But my thing is, if stop and frisk was never put in place, or if stop and frisk was put in place out in the communities, you know, in the suburbs, like Tawanda said, she said, you know, the officers are out there playing and speaking to the kids and things like that. Here, it's more so I'm watching you, not I'm here for you. And that's the difference in the situation. So if you're not dealing with it firsthand, you kind of do brush it off. And I believe that's why we're here having this conversation now, because we deal with it directly every day.
Exactly. Tawana, tell us about West Wednesdays and how our listeners can support.
So if anybody can come out to West Wednesday, that would be really helpful. You can reach me on my Facebook page, Tawanda Jones, or you can reach me directly on my brother's page, and that's Justice for Tyrone West. And on this Wednesday at 6:30, this will be our 199th West Wednesday. We've been out here for 199 weeks, and we will be on Green Mountain 33rd at 6:30. And then next week for the 200 West Wednesday, we will be at City Hall at 6:30. We're actually doing like a little cookout, things like that, at City Hall at 6:30 the following Wednesday. So if you want to reach out, that will be definitely totally appreciated. And I just wanted to let everybody know, too, it seemed like it's us today, but like you said, when you got somebody, when an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere, and to think that if any cops are getting away with bloody murder and they got that taste for blood, it's almost like we got a stray animal on the prowl. You got a dog that's a stray animal biting people and they got the taste of blood, that dog's going to do what? Commit other acts of violence. It's going to keep on biting people. So don't wait till it bites in your community to get involved and say, no, this is not right. Do something now before it gets to your door, because then it's too late.
Thank you. And while we at it, Tawana, just tell everyone how they can find you one more time and how they can reach out to you on social media.
Yeah, so they can reach me on my Facebook page, Tawanda Jones, or you can reach me on Instagram, Justice for Tyrone West. And you can also reach me on Facebook through Justice for Tyrone West. We have a page as well for him. Or you can email me at Miss Tawanda, and that's MISSTAWANDA 17@yahoo.com.
Great, thank you. And Seth, where can we find you at?
I am at the University of South Carolina School of Law. I'm on Twitter at Police Law Prof, at Police Law Prof, and you're always welcome to email me swstough@law.sc.edu.
Thank you. And Amelia?
Yep. You can always find me on Twitter at XOAmelia. If anybody wants to shoot me any questions related to episode 11, as far as Freddie's injuries, the autopsy report and stuff, I'm happy to answer questions on Twitter. And I just want to say that I think that Tawanda Jones is a phenomenal hero of a woman. And I seriously, like, I hope so much for you that you get justice for your brother, because he it's sickening that it hasn't happened yet. And I think you're a freaking warrior. And I admire you so much. I just really wanted to say that.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
you're welcome.
We're here fighting for you. And Tierra?
You can find me on all social media platforms at Tierra Lanice, TIARALANICE.
And I'm on all social media platforms at DWatkinsWorld. Fans can discuss the episode with the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda with the hashtag UDAddendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle at undisclosedPOD. Thank you and have a great day.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. As always, a big thanks to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum, along with super producer Methil Telhan. A big thanks to this week's sponsor, Mack Weldon. Mack, Louisiana heat is starting to kick my butt, so it's nice to have Mack on my body to keep me comfortable. To our fans, thank you for supporting our sponsors. Great sponsorship makes for great podcasts. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's Webby Award-winning theme music. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who lends his sound to our show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly, and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, episode 12. Until then.